Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Jhumpa Lahiri. She is the author, most recently, of a novel, The Namesake, published by Houghton Mifflin. Her book of stories, Interpreter of Maladies, was published by Houghton Mifflin as well several years ago, now available in paperback, and won the Pulitzer Prize. I wanted to begin by asking you, this is an almost entirely metaphor-free style. There's no, very little adornment in the prose, and most of it is extremely factual, not figurative. Are there models, were there models for you for this kind of writing?
I hope so. I certainly look to other writers for guidance in my, you know, in my style, my sentences, in crafting my sentences. And I think the writers I admire most in that regard tend to be very plain-spoken, sort of very much in the background of their work in a way. And William Trevor is someone I greatly admire for that, for many reasons, but particularly for his voice, which is so, to me, so powerful, but so very, very plain-spoken at the same time. And I sort of strive for that. And I think more and more as I, you know, move from work to work, I think I'm moving toward a more simple kind of way of telling things.
It amazed me because in The Namesake, the book's son is named by his father, Gogol, who had been reading Gogol in India in a train wreck. And it's the flapping of a page after that wreck that attracts the rescuer's attention and saves his life. But Gogol seems to be the opposite here. I think Nabokov says this is a writer in whom parallel lines will not meet because they have so many other things they want to do. Never a straight line, always a digression, and always, if possible, a surprising metaphor. So I wondered, you know, to have a book under the auspice of Gogol, what was that an irony for you?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people have been asking me about that recently, and you know, sort of asking, well, if I read The Overcoat, will I understand your novel on a deeper level or anything like that? And I tell them no. I mean, I admire Gogol enormously, but he hasn't been one of the writers in my sort of personal pantheon, you know, of writers that I sort of turn to the way that I say would, I think I would list Chekhov or Tolstoy before Gogol in terms of the Russians, or even Nabokov for that matter. But I think that in a way, it's the very lack of connection between, you know, Nikolai Gogol and his life and his work and the life of my character, of my Gogol, that is what the book is about in a way, is that they really don't have anything in common and that there's this sort of profound lack of connection or correspondence between those two things that is one of the things that plagues my character most deeply, you know. So there's no sort of intended secret parallel or coded message or anything like that.
Oh, no. In fact, I thought not. In fact, it seemed that the book is about accident and what's in a way offensive, although he has refused to read Gogol, is he seems to know that the name has been chosen for some strange reason. His father hasn't told him, but it sounds to others like an Indian name. And so it seems like an accident name, you know, and for him it just sounds awkward, especially with his last name. Can you say it?
Gogol Ganguly is the full name.
And he can't imagine quite calling up a girl and telling her who's on the phone.
Right.
And what to... he feels in a certain way that it creates an expectation other than himself, although he doesn't know yet who he is. And this is going to be a book in which he defines himself. Now, when he changes his name, it's not that he's ashamed of being of Bengali parentage, because he changes his name to
Nikhil, which is also a Bengali, which is a Bengali name as opposed to Gogol.
and is also Gogol's first name.
Sort of, yes.
Sort of.
An Indian version of Gogol's first name, yes.
And so, you know, it is almost as if he's seeking for something that defines him more rather than less. Many names get changed in America in order to defy or run away from, conceal heritage. It's not heritage that disturbs him. What is it?
I think what disturbs him is the inappropriateness, what he thinks is the inappropriateness of the name, and also, you know, the fact that it is a Russian name and not even, it's neither Indian, you know, Bengali, nor is it an American name or an easily identifiable American or Western style name. And those are really the two sides of him, are, you know, the world of his parents versus the world of his peers and school and community and physical environment. And I think the other thing that bothers him, I imagine, is that the name is never intended for public use. That is, it was intended to simply be a pet name, a family name, a sort of private self name, and I think that he wants to sort of enter the world as a young adult with a proper name, and he's been born into a tradition where that distinction is maintained, you know, with his own parents and so forth.
And the child is meant to have a pet name used by the parents and intimates, yes?
Yes.
And then a good name.
Yes.
Is that in the sense of a good suit?
Well, it's sort of. It's sort of like you have the clothes you wear around the house, and then you have the clothes that you keep in the closet so that they look nice when you go out into the world. And it really is a similar kind of separation. You know, your pet name is used very much in a casual but very much based in the home and in the family in particular, and they're, you know, the names that that you have, I think, the most emotional connection to, in that's what your parents call you. And your good name is something that signifies another dimension of your life altogether. And we all have that. Each of us has, you know, the private self and the public self. But in Bengali culture, it's always been very interesting to me that separation is manifested literally in the use of the two names.
Well, names are very important, both in the culture and in the work, because in this book, The Namesake, by my guest, Jhumpa Lahiri, and as well in the final short story in The Interpreter of Maladies, the story, The Third and Final Continent, the wives have never spoken their husband's first name. Now, what makes a name unspeakable? Because in my knowledge of traditions, it's the name of God that's not used because it's sacred. But what informs this?
Well, I think it's a similar impulse in that it's considered somehow disrespectful to call someone by first name. And Bengali culture, and I think many other Indian many other regions of India have a very elaborate system for addressing the people you're related to and your elders. It's very refined, and you really, you know, I mean, my sister doesn't call me by my name because I'm older than she is. You know, there's a specific term that she calls me.
What does she call you?
She calls me Didi, yes. Which is the word for older sister. And, you know, and there are so many specific words for how you are related to someone, whether it's through your mother's side, your father's side, and an aunt on your mother's side by marriage will be called something other than an aunt on your father's side, not through marriage. You know, I mean, there's, if you can imagine the sort of degrees and the nuances of any sort of family structure, it's really quite fascinating.
Now tell me, do you think that this has an effect, the larger issues behind this, on the writing itself? Because as I was reading The Namesake, I became aware not of judgments, but of an ongoing code of behavior. The mother here notices that America is a place where people keep cat litter boxes in the kitchen. Or she feels, if I remember correctly, shocked that most of the children claim to be allergic to milk. In other words, constantly going on around the characters are a swarm of recognitions of difference. And it seems as if the writing is always keeping a cool eye, not violating the set of differences, but very respectful of it, to know that it's always in operation. It seemed to me significant that one of the first books we hear about, the woman-to-be Gogol's wife, is reading Pride and Prejudice. And it seems like this is, in these stories, an ordered world of prose and sensibility, an attempt to recreate a certain decorous order. Yes, no?
That's a complicated, very interesting comment and question. I think to go back to your first point, I think that my whole existence, my consciousness as a person and eventually as a writer has been to absorb difference, you know, on a daily basis. I think that's what happens when you grow up kind of biculturally or however, you know, you want to sort of think of it. I led two very different lives every day, you know. As soon as I started to go to school, I spoke two different languages every day. I ate two different kinds of food every day, you know. And I think that all of that experience just sort of, you know, was all dependent on the fact that I had to move back and forth from the way it was done, you know, at home and the way things were done when I went to visit a friend or went to school or what have you. And I think that it was, you know, I never felt that it was a matter of choosing one way or the other way, but that it was just more that it was a matter of absorbing and understanding that there were always two ways, that there were always two sides to everything. So I think that I, you know, in my work, I try not to judge. I don't, I try not to be a very judgmental person. I have opinions, certainly. I think things are right and wrong and better or worse. But in terms of cultural practices, I think that's the thing that my work kind of centers on most, is cultural difference or you know, displacement, dislocation, and just simply the way people live, you know. And I think that I've always been so attuned to the fact that people live lives differently and that there are different ways of going about things, of getting married, of eating dinner, of, you know, decorating your house or or, you know, anything, just sort of the day-to-day of life. But, and yet that can seem like such a profound separation, you know, between people.
I'm speaking to Shumpa Lahiri. Am I doing that right,
yes,
by the way?
Yes, you are.
Thank you. And her new book is The Namesake. It's a novel published by Houghton Mifflin. Now, I noticed that, say, as opposed to Chekhov, Hemingway, the people whose subject matter is virtually about the ways in which people cannot talk to one another, that in your work, the closer people are, the harder it will be for them to express these things, and that strangers, witness the woman in the title story, Interpreter of Maladies, are likely perhaps to blurt out without any sensitivity things that are huge secrets, but that the real difficulty in talking comes when people are very close, which seems to make you different from most of the people who use that technique of watching communication fail with great precision.
Well, I think in The Namesake there are certainly examples of communication either failing or extremely challenged between, say, husband and wife, father and son, you know, intimate relationships. But I think that that's always the case. I think it's hardest for us to communicate honestly with the people we love and care for, because the stakes are so high. You know, to blurt out a secret to a stranger is kind of, you know, it's much easier because there are no consequences, really. Or you may think there are no consequences. Maybe the stranger would feel otherwise. But, you know, I do think that my work is a lot about the failure to communicate.
Now, there seems to be something technically afoot, which is that even though Gogol changes his name and other people use his changed name, some do, some don't, the narrator never does. He's Gogol throughout the book, suggesting in a way somehow that he will always be, that his essence is Gogol. It makes the narrator, the third person omniscient narrator, seem to have made a different decision from the one Gogol has made in changing his name. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, I thought about, you know, I thought, well, what would it be like if suddenly at page 120 or whatever it is, suddenly it's, you know, he becomes Nikhil, literally, and that everything is, you know, that the narrator is observing Nikhil doing these things rather than Gogol. And I just thought that would be far too, I don't know, sort of gimmicky and pat and not life in a way. I think, you know, for me, so much of the book is about the struggle to both escape who we are and return to our origins. You know, the parents are trying to return, to hold on desperately to where they've come from, and their children are struggling desperately to move away. And there's sort of a back and forth that all of the characters experience in that sense. And I think it's a very universal experience. You don't have to be an immigrant to go through that sort of thing, you know, the basic sort of course of life and what happens when you're born into a family and as you age and the different stages you go through and how you relate to your parents and your origins and the world you're born into. You know, so I think that's what I had very much in mind. And I think that if Gogol were suddenly to become Nikhil from the narrator's point of view, it would suggest something I don't believe, which is that we can fully obliterate what we've come from, even though we can add to it and amplify and edit ourselves, in a sense, through life. There is a sense that of you know, that you can't escape certain basic facts. You can't escape who gave birth to you. You know, you can't change that. And to me, the whole process of names and naming speaks so strongly about who our parents are. You know, even though we sort of think, I think we come to think that names are very much about ourselves and, you know, this is my name and I own it and I possess it and it speaks for me and who I am. But, you know, I think anyone who's had a child, named a child, quickly realizes that it really is about, it's about you, you know. I mean, I named my son with my husband and we made that decision. He didn't make it, but one day he'll grow up and the name will speak so much about who he is, you know. But it's, we often lose sight of that, I think.
Although Gogol almost drifts into a panel discussion about ABCDs and the conflicted nature of growing up double, what I took away from the book was that these were human problems, that it wasn't about a particular culture versus America. It was about tradition, and every family has one in America, and that his growth had something to do with understanding that his impulse to date American women or to be divorced when he finally does marry a woman whose family is from Bengali, that these are not questions about ethnicity. These are the life questions that everyone is asking, inflected in every case in a certain way by the facts of their existence.
Well, I it gratifies me enormously to hear you say that. I hope that that's really what the book is about at its heart. And I wasn't thinking, you know, to me it was always a family story and very much about, as I said, you know, about simply the life process, being born, being taken care of, then slowly, you know, sort of trying to find yourself, becoming independent. And I think it's an interesting process to look at in light of the immigrant experience where people are literally moving away from their home. And to me, you know, having parents who did that, who did immigrate, it really wasn't so much about my parents leaving a country or a culture. It was much more specific. It was my father leaving his parents. It was my mother leaving her parents. That was what it was about, and that was the root of all of their pain, their frustration, their sadness. You know, and I learned that was really what it was about, and I think that that's something that can happen to anybody, even if you are born and live and die in the same town your whole life. You know, there comes a point when you there are these necessary junctures and separations. You know, that's just how life works.
As a result, and this is a final question, but it's a complicated one. In this book, death happens somewhere else. The man who does die on the train, when Gogol's father is almost killed, dies away from his wife and children. Gogol's father is all alone when he meets his death in another American city. But our first knowledge of death in this book, The Namesake, by my guest Shumbo Lahiri, is the death of the boy's grandfather, which occurs in a sense by phone and almost can't be spoken. The brother who's called tells his brother-in-law one thing, but his sister, he can't tell her that their father is dead. And there is the sense of people experiencing death in different ways over and over again from afar. No one is ever next to a person mm-hmm. who is dying or about to die. There's this experience of distance. And I wanted to ask you that, about that, last of all.
Well, I think that that is, you know, that was my experience of growing up and watching my parents lose their parents. It was always, always too late. They were never at their parents' sides. And the calls always came in the middle of the night, or they were letters if the relation was, you know, even a dear aunt or an uncle, you know. I mean, my mother has stories of, you know, just, you know, people she loved so much, aunts and uncles, and it would just be a letter in the mailbox in the afternoon in Rhode Island. And because it was such a different time then, you know, I mean, phone calls were so rare, so expensive, you know, the world wasn't the way it is now. There was no email. The lines themselves were horrible, crackly, you know. It just seemed like calling the moon, you know. And so that was my introduction to that side of life, to death, which, you know, every child begins to experience eventually, you know, but we never attended a funeral. We were never physically there. And I think that I imagine was an experience of not just my family, but of many, many people who lived the sorts of lives that my parents lived, you know, in which they were living in a new place. They were struggling to, you know, kind of make a living and live in a new land. They didn't have huge amounts of money to spare to just hop on a plane. And also death can also be very sudden and unexpected. And so I think I was kind of working with some of those memories in writing about the deaths in this book.
Well, it's interesting to me because of all of the issues of intimacy and violation of intimacy, death remains something that in a way happens on the moon, happens at a great distance, even between people in America. It's almost as if people are sent away to put distance between them when they die, almost as if death is the foreign culture that you can't know.
Well, it's the ultimate world that you can't know, right?
I've been speaking to Shrimpa Lahiri about her novel, The Namesake. She is the author as well of Interpreter of Maladies, a book of short stories for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. Both have been published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you, Shrimpa, for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You can read the first chapter of The Namesake on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with the book of the mouse, mouse time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.